Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. To support great podcasts like this one, please donate by clicking the link in the show description. We bring you interviews today with both sides of the debate over how to respond to the recent rise in violent crime in the United States. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Jonathan Blanks. He is a criminal justice researcher, also research fellow in criminal justice at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. First, though, we'll talk with Rafael Mangual. He is head of research for the Policing and Public Safety Initiative at the Manhattan Institute and also author of the recent book Criminal Injustice, What the Push for Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most. Rafael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The question before us today is what to do, how to address the rise in crime across the country, or at least in some areas across the country. First of all, this is a subject in which there is a lot of data out there. What can you tell us about what we know about crime happening across the country, how it compares to, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's across the country compared to 10 years ago, things have gotten significantly worse, right? I think the first thing that we have to do if we're going to, you know, address the question of how we go about responding to the rise in crime that we've seen in recent years, the first thing we need to do is just to take a step back and understand that we shouldn't make the mistake of speaking about crime in national terms, or even in statewide terms, or even citywide terms. The most important thing that I think people don't understand about crime is that it is very hyper-concentrated. It's concentrated geographically and it's concentrated demographically. And that really is kind of step one to addressing the problems. You have to understand the contours of the problem and where the problem exists and where it doesn't. So if you were to take, you know, a sort of national view, you would be missing a lot, right? Because, you know, for example, the nation's homicide rate is probably somewhere around 7 per 100,000 at this point. But that doesn't really tell you very much about how safe you are in a given place at a given time, right? About 2% of counties every single year will see about 50% of all murders, whereas about 60% of counties won't see any murders in a given year. So, you know, just based on that county level kind of analysis, you're risk of being, you know, violently victimized varies quite a bit. Within counties, within cities, crime is more hyper-concentrated still. So if you take New York, for example, we have 82,000 street segments, give or take, in the city. A street segment would be, if you're thinking of a city block, you know, one side of the block, you know, corner to corner, two sidewalks. Out of our 82,000 street segments, about 3.5% will see 50% of all violent crime. So step one to really understanding the crime problem and formulating a, you know, coherent plan with respect to how to respond to it is to just get a really good detailed understanding of where the problem is and among whom it concentrates, right? So I talked a little bit about the geographic concentration, but it's also very demographically concentrated. So in New York City, for example, last year the NYPD reported that 97% of all 2021 shooting victims were either Black or Hispanic. Almost all of them were male. And a huge portion of that victimization group is going to be between the ages of 15 and 35. You know, at the national level, a Black male has a homicide victimization rate that's about 10 times that of a white male. And all this will change if that person's gang involved, if their social network contains people who've been arrested with, you know, guns in the past or who are in gang databases, et cetera. So, you know, what you really want to do is kind of drill down using the available data to get a really good sense of where your crime problem is, among whom it concentrates. And then, you know, the next step would be deploying your police resources to those places and to concentrate them among those people. You know, once you've identified the sort of, you know, if you're talking about a city the size of New York, then maybe, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 or so people who are, you know, driving the bulk of your violence, then you can start to concentrate prosecutorial resources on those people. and, you know, work to kind of investigate them in ways that will lead to cases that, when they stick, will take those individuals off the street for a significant period of time, giving those communities the room to breathe. And so I think if I were to sort of distill all of that into, you know, a quick sentence, I think the best thing that we can do in response to the current crime problem is draw on the lessons that were learned over the course of the 1990s and early 2000s, which were periods of, you know, really unprecedented success with respect to crime control.
So on the success of the 1990s, a frequent data point is what happened in New York City during the decade of the 1990s to bring that homicide rate down precipitously and other types of violent crime. When you look at the lessons learned in New York City during that time, can we still do it today? Can it work in other places? And is all of that policing and all of those strategies still legal in this country?
Yeah, so I think the answer to the question of can we do it today, I think the answer is obviously yes. Not only can we do it today, we can do it even better. The more important question, unfortunately, for our time is whether we have the political will to do it. And so, unlike the period of the 1990s, where every single aspect of the criminal justice apparatus was kind of on the same page with respect to their mission, you know, what's different about today is that sometimes the police and other parts of the criminal justice system are working at cross purposes, and that wasn't true, you know, 30, 40 years ago. What I mean by that is that I think the police in New York City are still doing a really, really good job of sort of deploying their resources in accordance with what the data say is going to have the biggest impact. They're obviously concentrating their resources on the right people. We know that because every time there's someone who's arrested for a really serious violent offense, it, you know, invariably turns out that they have very lengthy arrest histories, which, you know, again, tells you that the police are sort of focusing on the right people. The problem that we have today is that the criminal justice system more broadly has kind of moved away from that sort of central mission. And so the impact of police is going to be more muted today than it was in the 1990s. Why? Because when they make an arrest today, it's more likely that the person arrested is going to be back out on the street very quickly as a result of, you know, different bail policies that were enacted in recent years. It's much more likely that that case will be dismissed as a result of different discovery rules that have been enacted in recent years. If that person's a juvenile, it's very, very likely that their case will stay in family court, which means that it's almost very unlikely that they will be handed a significant sentence of incarceration, which means that they'll be back on the street in a shorter period of time than they would have been in prior years. And that's a result of recent juvenile justice reforms. If we're talking about parolees, it's going to be much more difficult today compared to what it was in, say, 2020 to violate someone for, you know, to revoke someone's parole for a violation. And so all of the efforts of police are sort of always been dependent on broader criminal justice system efforts. And, you know, that's where the disconnect happens today. I mean, you have progressive prosecutors in New York and Brooklyn and Manhattan who, you know, to varying degrees may not necessarily be on the same page. They're dropping or choosing not to charge certain types of offenses. They are supporting parole, you know, as a kind of default. They're capping the sentences that they'll seek. And so all of this is going to mean that, you know, whatever you do with respect to the tip of the spear of the enforcement apparatus, which is police, you know, the question of whether we can have the same impact will depend on whether we have the political will to roll back some of the recent reforms and refine them to address the kind of gaps that they have left us with respect to public safety.
If we talk about stricter enforcement, Rafael, or prosecuting those crimes that come before a judge, should we be concerned, should we ever be concerned about, say, the raw number of people who are behind bars in this country? Does it matter if it gets past a certain number? Does that number matter?
Yeah, not so much, right? I mean, I think this is one of the errors of how we've had our public debate on this is, you know, we kind of talk about our incarceration numbers as if they're sort of prima facie evidence of an over or under incarceration problem. I mean, you know, there is no right number based on the size of a country, you know, with respect to how many people should be behind bars. I think the right analysis is, you know, are we responding correctly to actual crimes. And so, you know, for example, in New York, we are the proportion of felony arrests that are resulting in incarcerations have gone down. That number has gone down significantly over the last 10 years. It is not at all clear that this is that 10 years ago that was sort of the right number. What we want to do is ask how many crimes are being committed, how many of those crimes are being committed by people who need to be incapacitated, and then are we incapacitating those people? Sometimes that number is going to be higher if crime rates go up. Sometimes it's going to be lower if crime rates go down. But you know, the idea that there's kind of a magic number that we should already know before we get the data on what crime looks like, I think, is a little unsophisticated.
Some of the criminal justice reform advocates talk about reducing interactions with police, reducing the opportunity for something to go wrong, reducing the opportunity for something to end up on social media, perhaps down the road, if police officers aren't acting as they should be. I know in the book you talk about reactive versus proactive policing. Do you think that a more proactive policing stance, perhaps even recommending more interactions with police, is a possible solution to the crime problem?
I certainly think it's part of the solution, right? I think we have to have an integrated approach across and throughout the criminal justice system, and that includes both policing, prosecution, sentencing, and, you know, corrections policy. You know, this idea that we should minimize police interactions because they might go wrong really stems from a fundamental misunderstanding of what the data say about police use of force. You know, we are having lots of sort of national level conversations, perhaps understandably, about police use of force in light of viral incidents. But that has really led to a skewing of the public sense of how common or widespread this problem is to the extent that it is a problem, right? I think there are certainly individual instances in which the police abuse their authority and do that through the use of excessive force. The question, though, is not whether that happens. The question is whether it happens enough to constitute an institutional problem that requires a response that's aimed at the institution. And so the idea that we should minimize police interactions because they might go wrong reflects a sense that this is really an institutional level problem, but the data undermine that argument. And so that's, I think, the first error with the sort of, you know, way that people frame that argument. But the second point is that one of the reasons why we should want police to interact with people more, particularly in the places where crime concentrates, is that through even low-level enforcement interactions, which is to say interactions that are based on, you know, misdemeanor offenses like littering or public urination or fare evasion, police will often discover more serious criminal conduct that they wouldn't have otherwise discovered had it not been for that interaction, right? So if you take New York City as an example, in 2020, some 42% of all illegal gun recoveries originated as traffic stops, right? So traffic stops are one of these examples of, you know, low-level encounters that people want to minimize. Well, it's one of the most effective ways that we can use to get guns off the street that shouldn't be there. But without those traffic stops, we would never sort of develop the probable cause that leads to the searches that then leads to the recovery of the weapons, mm-hmm. and then sometimes to the incarceration of the serious offenders. And so, you know, when you're talking about these offenses, we cannot pretend as if the categories of offenders who commit these lower level offenses and those that commit more serious offenses are static, which is to say that we have to recognize that there's an overlap. And so because really serious offenders will also violate, you know, the law in lower level ways, we need to enforce those lower level rules because that will often give us the opportunity to discover more serious criminal conduct.
I have to ask about the idea, and not just the idea, but the execution of bail reform in some areas of the country. Illinois, for example, was scheduled to become the first state to go completely without cash bail. That's been put on hold for the moment. Is bail reform, the elimination of cash bail, not a more fair way of dealing with some of these crimes where you take the factor of money and wealth out of the equation when it comes to some of these crimes?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It doesn't have to take the form that it's taken in so many places, which has really just been, you know, I think if you step back and sort of understand the central critique of cash bail, it has merit, right? I mean, the central critique of cash bail is that it basically renders the question of whether someone will spend the pretrial period in custody or free depends on their access to wealth, right? Mm-hmm. How much can you come up with this amount of money? And so, you know, in a system like that, you might end up with situations in which you have a relatively harmless but indigent defendant that gets stuck behind bars for, you know, say months while they wait for their case to be disposed of. Whereas you have a dangerous but wealthy defendant that's able to buy his or her freedom by virtue of their access to wealth, even though they pose a significant risk to the public. And so there are a couple of ways that you can address that. You can essentially eliminate cash bail so that everyone gets out, but then you lose out on the potential public safety benefits that would be associated with the temporary incapacitation of people through pretrial detention. Or you can sort of reorient the inquiry around a risk as opposed to wealth, which is what I would propose that we do. Now, I don't think you have to fully eliminate cash bail to do that. And the reason I wouldn't fully eliminate cash bail is that I do think that there is some subset of offenders for whom you could sufficiently mitigate the risk of reoffending by tying their behavior to the money that they put up, right? Mm-hmm. So people understand bail to be a sort of surety that you put up, and if you show up, you get that money back. If you don't show up, if you abscond, then that money gets forfeited, right? But you can also tie the forfeiture of that money to compliance with the conditions on your release, including not engaging in new criminal conduct. And for some people, you could probably do that sufficiently without having to incarcerate them in pretrial detention. And so, you know, for that reason alone, I wouldn't fully eliminate cash bail. But I do think that we can get to a place where we rely on cash bail much, much less than we do now without losing out on the public safety benefits associated with pretrial detention. And the way that we do that is by basically doing an analysis for every single defendant that comes before the court. They're very easy to use algorithmic risk assessments that will sort of set out a bunch of questions that when answered, you know, will give you a score. And the score will be associated, will be measured up against certain thresholds that will indicate low risk, medium risk, or high risk. And then judges can make decisions based on those risk ratings about who to incarcerate pretrial and who not to. But that is, I think, a much smarter way to go about bail reform. And I think that if we did that, you know, we wouldn't see as much of the crime that I think we're seeing in some of these places, like Chicago, like New York, and the critiques wouldn't be as harsh as they are, and maybe this wouldn't take up so much air in terms of the public debate, and we could get to some other things. But it really is important for us to understand that, you know, when we're talking about, like, say, a concept like deterrence, right? One of the most important principles in the deterrence literature is called the clarity principle, which means that, you know, it basically just means that the swiftness with which a sanction is handed out is just as, if not sometimes more important than the severity of the sanction itself. And if you're talking about someone who engages in criminal conduct and gets arrested, sometimes pretrial detention is going to be the sort of most immediate consequence associated with those actions. Mm-hmm. And if we eliminate pretrial detention, we may actually be undermining the initial deterrent effect that coming into contact with the criminal justice system has. And that, I think, could have an important effect down the road.
One final question for Rafael Manguel. His book is Criminal Injustice, What the Push for Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most. How much of this spike in violent crime in some concentrated areas in the country is residue from the unrest, the riots of 2020 versus, say, a normal quote-unquote sort of crime path? Will a spike remain? Will it come down naturally?
I don't think it will come down naturally. I think we will have to bring it down through policy and enforcement. I do think that some of it is residue from the unrest and the riots, but it comes through the following mechanism, which is to say that the unrest and the riots were part and parcel of a broader demonization of the policing profession. That demonization, I think, has done a couple of things. One, it has discouraged people from becoming police officers who weren't already cops. And that has contributed to a pre-existing recruitment and retention crisis. on top of that, it has discouraged people who are police from staying on the job longer, which is why you've seen such a spike in so many parts of the country in early retirements and resignations. Mm-hmm. For the people who have chosen either to become cops or who have chosen to stay on the force, it has discouraged them from being proactive out in the field. And that in turn also has an effect on their ability to stamp out crime, because, you know, if they are afraid that they, you know, should they have a use of force incident that goes viral, that they won't be given the benefit of the doubt and that they'll be tried and convicted in the court of public opinion, well, then, you know, it makes sense that we would see them kind of try and minimize their risk by not taking proactive actions as often as they otherwise might have. And so I think that, combined with the effect that the protests and the riots had on the public policy debate, which, you know, that effect was the enactment of a number of different policies aimed at reforming police and the criminal justice system writ large over a very short period of time. That kind of rash policy response is also having a residual effect. And so until we sort of reinforce police, both in terms of, you know, just the numbers of police officers on the street, but also, you know, reinforce their sense of security. And until we examine what reforms were misguided and need to be either rolled back or tinkered with, until all of those things happen, I think that we are going to continue to see crime remain at elevated levels, if not continue to go up in certain parts of the country. You know, I think the most important takeaway, though, is that what happened in 2020 is not what would fall under the umbrella of kind of a normal variation in our crime rate. I mean, we saw the single largest one-year increase in homicides in American history in 2020. And that is not natural. And it's going to take, you know, policy and enforcement to get that back.
Rafael Manuel, he is the author of Criminal Injustice, What the Push for Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most, also head of research for the Policing and Public Safety Initiative at the Manhattan Institute. Rafael, thanks so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
For a different view on this topic, we turn to Jonathan Blanks. He is a criminal justice researcher and also a research fellow in criminal justice at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
We discussed today, and hopefully get toward an answer, or your best answer, for how to address the recent rise in violent crime in at least some parts of our country. I want to ask first by trying to get you to tell me what you think or what should be the goal of our criminal justice system. Is it punishment? Is it deterrence? Is it rehabilitation of those who are convicted? Is it finding justice for victims? Where do you place the goal of our criminal justice system?
Well, I think the first thing to think about is that different parts of our criminal justice system are there for different things, right? So broadly construed, obviously, we just want a safer place. We want people to be able to live free and without, you know, the impediments of being victimized in some way or another. But we also want people to have a sense of security. So like when they walk down the street, they, you know, they're not harassed by cops, you know, papers, please, sort of Nazi Germany stuff, right? So there are a bunch of things you have to balance. But so if you like, what is incarceration for? You could say there's a lot of arguments about that. I think, you know, you could say that it's to incapacitate people who are a danger to society. It is to rehabilitate them. It is to punish them. You know, I think there's arguments for all three of those. I think the most important public policy, in my opinion, would be to incapacitate those who are legitimately dangerous to society. But for the, you know, for the judicial system, it's basically, you know, did the accused get a fair trial, and also, you know, weigh the evidence to see if, you know, whether or not they are in fact guilty. But in the police, you know, and then the police are, you know, the sort of daily maintenance. They're the people that we see on the street all the time, right? That's the most visible part of the government and the criminal justice system. And they're going to be there for like traffic enforcement. They're there for like just keeping the peace, but they're also there to interdict crime and then sometimes to investigate and catch bad guys, right? So that is sort of like the very, you know, elevator pitch broad scope for the system as, you know, in general. But I think focusing on policing, which is where most of my work does, I really think it's about, you know, putting police in the right places to make communities safe while keeping the individuals secure at the same time.
You wrote a piece recently, and in discussing the decline in violent crime in the 90s and into the aughts, wrote a sentence that went, "As crime declined precipitously, however, arrests and incarceration continued to mount." Could you substitute the word "because" for "however" in that sentence, or do you not think that there is a link, or at least a strong link, between the decline in crime and the rise in arrests and incarceration?
No, I don't think there's. I think there is some, you know, correlation there, obviously, but I don't think because if there's no direct evidence between arrests and crime rates, right? So for a long time, we had, like, you know, back in the 90s, you know, we did have a really serious crime problem. And it's not that it's not serious now, but insofar as when that started to decline, a whole bunch of different reasons. No one has a firm answer. I think Patrick Sharkey has the best explanation. But insofar as, like, arrests and incarceration, that's not it. We're getting diminishing marginal returns, to use the economics term. So it's not that arresting bad people and getting dangerous people off the street isn't a good thing. But insofar as we're arresting a lot more people and incarcerating a lot more people than necessarily are, in fact, dangerous to society. And so, and particularly when we're talking about the drug war, which I also bring up in the piece, we are arresting millions of people for marijuana, for example, but most of them aren't doing hard time, but that doesn't mean that there aren't extra, you know, consequences to those arrests. And therefore, it's like, are you actually making their lives better? Are you making the community safer by arresting all those people? And I don't think there is. I don't think they are. So yes, I think there's a place for arrests, and I think there are a place for, particularly for violent crime, but insofar as, you know, just arrest as public policy tool, I think it's overused.
Do you think, or can you point to a particular cause for the most recent rise in violent crime in the country? You wrote in that same piece that essentially the violent crime drop could not last forever. Is it something just cyclical in your mind?
I think that, I mean, because the data lag on this is so long, like, so we're getting crime data, we don't know exactly what all is going on. So, for example, certain areas, both in, like, my home state of Indiana, but also just across, I live in D.C. now, but just across the river in Alexandria, Virginia, or no, excuse me, it's Fairfax, Virginia. You know, police departments are complaining about domestic violence homicides, right? Where people are, because it was during the pandemic and people were trapped inside and, you know, drinking too much and having guns and, you know, that sort of thing happened. I don't think that's the major driver of that. I think there was also, you know, this sort of traditional crime, you know, street crime, drug deals gone bad, et cetera, et cetera. So you see in Chicago and whatnot. So, but we don't have enough data right now to say there's a particular point, what exactly happened. But I think you have the destabilization of the pandemic. You have economic issues. You have, you know, just kids not in school. You know, they don't have any sort of organized structure to, you know, keep them busy. And you, of course, you know, crime is most common among young men. And so if you take away some structure out of their lives and you don't give them anything to do and their guns around and there's drugs and all that sort of stuff, I think that's just going to lead to bad things. So it's a matter of putting resources in the right place and getting, you know, so there's both the criminal justice aspect of it, which is getting cops in the right areas to, you know, be visible and prevent crime. And you know, also dealing with those kids and making sure they're not, you know, doing something and then shooting each other.
Jonathan Blanks with us, a research fellow in criminal justice at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. I'm going to ask about a couple of different angles on the subject and topic of criminal justice reform, where we've been and perhaps where we're going. Is there a strong argument for a move toward fewer interactions between police and the public? Does less policing perhaps lead to better policing in your mind?
Yes and no. So I think we should have fewer antagonistic contacts between police and the public, particularly I wrote a law review article a few years ago on pretextual traffic stops. And basically, it's when cops are looking for drugs and guns, and they're stopping people almost at random, but particularly in, you know, what are known as high crime neighborhoods, or, you know, and they are typically black neighborhoods. And so sometimes they will find a car laden with guns and drugs, and, you know, getting those off the street is good. But, you know, how many innocent people did they stop and they search, and did they invade their security to do that. And that's like, you know, the New York City stop and frisk problem program was, you know, similar. They stopped 4 million people and they found 8,000 guns, which is a hit rate of what, 0.2%, you know, over 10 years. So it's just a matter of like making smarter policing. Like if you're going to be antagonistic, have a reason to do it. But the thing is, we know from evidence-based policing research that is done, you know, in cooperation with police departments by a lot of times former police professionals, and they realize that hotspots policing, where crime for whatever reason tends to be geographically isolated and like in like sometimes very, very small geographic pockets, and putting cops there, visible cops, not plain clothes, not unmarked cars, but marked cars, not necessarily lights on, you know, actually can decrease the incidence of crime in that area. And so that gives you an opportunity to put police in those areas. So you have more policing, you have more police there, but they're not necessarily shaking down everyone in the area. Right. And and that can by itself can, you know, decrease crime. And so it's not a matter of depolicing that I'm not of the opinion that we need to get cops off the streets and, you know, defund the police and all that. That's not my bag. What I am saying is we need to have fewer unnecessary antagonistic contacts between police and the public, because at the end of the day, the police need the public to help them solve crimes. And if the people don't trust the police, they're not going to cooperate. And then you're just going to have more unsolved crimes. And the communities that need help the most aren't going to get it.
Jonathan, you write about extraordinarily long drug sentences as a form of persistent racial injustice in the criminal justice system. Is solving that problem a judge issue, a changing the law issue, a prosecutor or defense issue? How do those sentences get, in your mind, too long?
I mean, I don't think it's just a racial issue, but I think that is something that has definitely been perceived that way, certainly particularly in the national context in the wake of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow book that came out in 2010. I think during the 80s and 90s, legislators saw the crack epidemic and they were just like, what are we going to do about this? And the one thing that they could do is like ratchet up sentences. And so that's something that they could do. And they also like put a lot more cops on the street and they did a bunch of other things. But that sort of thing where you had that plus the three strikes and you're out laws that basically said if you get convicted of three serious felonies, you're going to go away for life and that sort of thing. So people would get, you know, just an ounce of weed in some places was a felony. Boom. You know, you're life in prison for an ounce of weed. But that's also an enforcement issue. I think particularly less so now, particularly since so many states are legalizing drugs, particularly or legalizing marijuana, there's just much less focus that police are trying to put on drug raids. And so you're having fewer people going to prison for that. But at the federal level, it's still, it's obviously still in effect, but less so, I think. They have already started reducing sentences. Barack Obama let go a lot of so-called nonviolent drug offenders. Commuted their sentences during his administration. And that's all good, but I don't think it's sufficient. I think both progressives and libertarians particularly focus too much on like the drug war as like the cause of all these problems as opposed to like a symptom of what's going on. I think just over-enforcement and using the criminal justice system to correct social ills as opposed to actually using the police to make neighborhoods safer and the justice and incarceration for people who are genuine dangers to society. And I think that includes, you know, changing the laws, but also changing policies and, and enforcement priorities.
On the subject of drug enforcement, there's a strain of thought on, say, the law and order side of this debate that I believe this is your sort of characterization, and if not, correct me, but that drug arrest enforcement operations is essentially a form of violence prevention, that some of these people who are arrested because they are breaking these drug laws are going to end up in violent situations down the road. Is that a correct sort of summary of the situation? Is there any correlation? Does that prove out to be true? And even if it does, is that a wise way to go about our criminal justice efforts?
So this argument was most recently made in Rafael Mangual's recent book, Criminal Injustice. And he made that argument explicitly. I don't think it's not something that I've seen a lot, but it is something because I think it's usually sort of it's implied, but no one actually wants to come out and say that. But he did. So, you know, at least, you know, points for being honest. By enforcing drug laws, particularly in poor black neighborhoods where you already have, you know, less, you know, lower educational like opportunities, you have, you know, greater unemployment opportunity, I mean, unemployment problems, you're compounding the problems that's already going on in their lives. And make giving him a criminal record is just going to make things harder. I mean, we're not talking, you know, you can't tell me that so many millions of drug arrests are creating, are preventing millions and millions of, you know, homicides. You know, it's, it does, it doesn't, the math doesn't work. I mean, just on its face. So, so no, I don't think it's a good idea. I think, you know, if you need to find, like, if, so for example, in my neighborhood, in DC, you know, we have a homeless problem and we have a lot of people who are addicted to drugs, and you can just see them nod off all the time. It's usually an opiate as opposed to, you know, marijuana, you know, so the local, fire department and EMTs respond with Narcan and that sort of thing. When people are actually overdosing, the cops don't get directly involved until people are starting to really overdose. Cause nodding off is just sort of a symptom of, you know, doing the drugs again, not good, but insofar as this is what's going on. But when people start like dying or are at the risk of dying, that's when the police get involved, because they need to find the source of that drug to end it. And I think that is a very good use of both using policing resources and, you know, and in a way, in a carceral way, to like find the people and get them off the street who are putting, you know, literal poison out onto the streets. So it's not that there's no room for enforcement there. It's just a matter of prioritizing it and making sure you're getting the right people instead of just like arresting people because, you know, it's illegal and that's going to make people safer because there's just no evidence to show that.
Jonathan, on the subject of bail reform, some municipalities, some places have taken a few steps in that direction. You also have the state of Illinois, which until a judge put a halt to it, perhaps just temporarily, it passed a law and signed a law that would eliminate cash bail entirely in the state of Illinois. Is that too far, or is that a step in the right direction?
No, I think that's fine. That's basically what's going on here in D.C. because we're a federal jurisdiction. We haven't had cash bail in, I don't think, 40 years, something like that. And the thing is the whole point of bail is to make sure people show up. Right. They show up to their court date. And the thing is, D.C. does not have a no-show rate different than states with, you know, high bail, like New York State. It's not. So we're not having a bunch of people skipping. And that's the whole point. And then if you have a way to keep the like legitimately dangerous people in jail so they're not getting out, that's the ideal, right? Because again, innocent until proven guilty, the fact that you can hold people in prison, hold people in jail until their court date without, you know, without proving them guilty of anything, you know, is problematic. It doesn't mean it should never be used, but it should be used sparingly. But too often it is a way to get people to plead guilty or to cooperate in other areas, like become informants or something like that, because it's coercive to hold people in jail because you keep them out of, keep them away from getting a job. I mean, from going to their jobs, which means they may lose their jobs, which destabilizes their life, which actually made them more likely to do criminal acts, whether or not they committed the initial criminal act in the first place. Like, it's just all these downstream effects of, you know, pre-trial incarceration. Again, I think there's a role for it, but I think it's overused. And so I am very much in favor of states and localities experimenting with ways to let people out in way so they can still be productive members of the community before they, you know, face judgment for what they're accused of.
One final question for Jonathan Blanks on the topic of, say, non-policing alternatives to addressing a violent crime. I'm curious about what would be called violence interruption programs. I know that there have been many efforts in big cities to create and launch these programs. What does the data say about the success rates of these violence interruption programs?
I honestly I'm not that familiar with the data. I think violence interrupter is a good idea to try. I think we need to, because again, so often it's getting people with credibility in to talk with people who are at high risk of committing violence. We do know that data, you know, that shows that if you are connected to someone, if you're within, for lack of a better term, 2 degrees of separation of someone who has been shot and killed, your likelihood of being victimized is, particularly like, if you're an urban youth, your chance of being victimized or becoming a perpetrator are very, very high. It doesn't skew like strongly one way or the other, but it's one of those two. And so there are ways to like interdict with those people and make sure they're getting the support they need and they're not like, you know, going out and revenge killing, whether that is violence interrupters from people in the community or that whether it is some sort of state resource. That's great, so long as what's happening, which Chicago experimented with this, but they did it in the wrong way. And so far as they put this on a point system, and cops started treating these people as if they were all dangerous, as opposed to these people are at risk and we need to make sure that they're getting the help that they need. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of a backfire where they were trying to use evidence-based practices, but they didn't do it quite right. And so again, finding these people is, I think, a very good idea, and making sure that they're, you know, not committing crimes. But insofar as like whether or not writ large, in the 18,000, you know, police jurisdictions in the country, whether it's working or not, I don't know.
Jonathan Blanks, he is a criminal justice researcher and research fellow in criminal justice at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Scott Bertram. We thank both of our guests on today's program, Rafael Mangual, head of research for the Policing and Public Safety Initiative at the Manhattan Institute, and author of Criminal Injustice, What the Push for Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most, and Jonathan Blanks, criminal justice researcher and research fellow in criminal justice at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine podcasts from America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.